good.
Hi, my name's Nora. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Nora.
My sobriety date is December 26, 2013, and my home group is Serenity at Sunrise, that brand new group that I announced. Really excited to be a part of that and to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I always thought it was interesting when I first came in the rooms and people would talk about being a grateful alcoholic. I actually got a little angry when I used to hear that. How can you possibly be grateful to be an alcoholic? You know, how can you be grateful that you don't get to drink anymore? You have to go to these meetings in the bottom of these basements, take this time out of your life, rearrange your schedule. And today I get it. You know, today there is no place I'd rather be than in the bottom of the basement, than not drinking alcohol, because I don't need it anymore. I don't need that solution. I have an actual solution that works today through the power of the 12 steps, through the power of these rooms, and through a higher power of my own understanding. From a very early age, I always had a loving family, a really great life, really nothing to complain about and really nothing to drink about. But, you know, it wasn't my external circumstances as much as it was my internal mind. There's pictures of me at 3 years old opening up a box on Christmas, bigger than me, and yet my sister's opening up a tiny box, and all I can think about is, what does she have over there? Because that's how my mind works. It's always been about comparing myself to other people. It's always been about not feeling enough and needing more, something outside of myself to distract me from me, because I could never be comfortable with who I was. On the outside, you know, I was always bubbly, I was outgoing, and I could fool anybody. You know, I was very precocious, very intelligent, so I could talk a pretty good game, even from an early age, but I never felt comfortable. I never felt, you know, at ease in my own skin. And when they talk about alcoholism being a disease, it's that sense of dis-ease, that sense that I can't be comfortable unless I'm outside of myself. There is a disease of alcoholism in my family, although it's not a requirement. You know, it does happen to fit with the flow of things. So as a child, there was not alcohol in my parents' house. And they taught me from a very early age, alcohol is bad. You have the genes for alcoholism. You might become an alcoholic, so don't drink. So alcohol was really pushed away from an early age. And I've never seen either of my parents drunk. You know, some people have. Some people grew up right side by side, but not me. But that feeling that I had inside from an early age, it didn't take long until it became greater than me and I couldn't handle it. I started looking to things outside myself to satisfy that pain from a very early age. You know, a lot of acting out, a lot of kind of running away from home, engaging in other self-destructive behaviors. So by the time that I took my first drink, I needed it. It was like that itch I couldn't scratch. And when I finally could scratch it, it was a breath of fresh air. It was a sigh of relief. I was finally feeling okay. I had arrived, like they said in the big book, like I felt okay at once in my own skin. And I liked it because without my inhibition, you know, I'm generally very poised, very put together, very perfectionist, very type A. But when I drink, all bets are off. You know, who I become with that first drink, I don't have any say over. And people thought it was entertaining. Like, oh my God, Nora's insane again. And that's what I would do. You know, that became my defense mechanism pretty quickly. I always skated below the surface, again, functional on the surface, but internally feeling pretty deep and feeling pretty empty. I kept trying to escape those feelings. I do have outside issues as well, and they don't play nicely with my alcoholism, you know. But to my core, through and through, I am an alcoholic, you know. Alcohol becomes my solution, and when I first take that drink, I can't stop, and I don't know where I'm going to go after that next drink. So I managed to kind of keep things under wrap on the surface. You know, my parents knew something was wrong, but they couldn't quite put their finger on it. It was never so bad that I ended up in a cop car or I ended up with alcohol poisoning under their nose, but there was a lot of things going on behind the scenes that I kind of just kept to myself because I didn't think I could talk to anybody about it. I'd been in many therapists' offices talking about issues, talking about problems, but never really looking at what was going on head on because it was too painful to look at that. It was too uncomfortable to actually admit that, you know, that I was that hopeless, that I was that fearful, and that I was that empty inside. So for me, the way my alcoholism took me, when I went off to college, my alcoholism just about went down the big hill drop on a roller coaster. I went pretty far and pretty fast, pretty quickly. I was drinking on a regular basis. You know, I made grades, but I was constantly showing up to class drunk, hungover, messed up, getting into bad situations, hurting myself, hurting a lot of other people in many ways. But it didn't for a second cross my mind that maybe I have a problem with alcohol. You know, the fact that I was young didn't help me. You know, I was like, I'm in college. Everyone gets wasted in college. Everyone parties in college. Everyone does what I do. Not realizing that other people were starting to distance themselves from me because I was so out of control and I was so crazy and nobody wanted to be around me. You know, I always had to push the envelope. We could be out drinking, we could be out partying, you know, everyone would call it a night and I was still going, you know, because I didn't want to feel sober. I didn't want to sober up. I was a blackout drinker from the beginning. I drank for effect. I thought that's why people drink. People drink to black out. I didn't understand that not everybody blacks out and that apparently that's not normal because that was the purpose of drinking to me. And it didn't take long for me to have some really bad consequences. You know, by my second semester of college, I had mixed other substances with alcohol. I had overdosed and died and been resuscitated and earned myself a 72-hour stay in one of Connecticut's finest facilities. And I was still in very adamant denial that I had a problem with alcohol or any other substance. I remember talking to the counselor. They had me detoxing. And I said, no, I don't have a problem with substances. I just had a really bad week and I just went too hard. But that's not what people do. A normal person doesn't end up, you know, institutionalized. A normal person doesn't die on the table. You know, that's not normal. But to me, as an active alcoholic, it absolutely was. So I continued down that road for some time. You know, they tried to sit me down to talk about my drinking. I remember my father looking me in the eye and saying to me, Nora, you cannot drink. You're on medication. They've told you you can't drink. You know, it's not safe. And I assured him, really meaning it in my heart, that I wouldn't drink anymore. Really thinking, oh, yeah, I can stop. It's not a problem. And at that time, things were very tumultuous with my family because I created a lot of problem. I created a lot of pain. That's what I did best because I was so hurt inside. All I ever knew what to do was to hurt other people. And I ran. You know, I ran. I ended up moving to Pennsylvania with my father at that time. I went to an intensive outpatient setting, never really touching the substance abuse issues and remembering even a therapist sitting down and telling me, you know, you're really sick. You're really in a lot of trouble and you really need to get some help. She's like, I'm going to discharge you from this program because you're not getting anything out of it. Because I could not admit. I could not admit that I had a problem. I could not admit that I was out of control. Because I couldn't look. The pain was way too deep. And I continued to do what I was doing. I continued to drink alcoholically. I continued to hurt a lot of people in the process. On the surface, I was fine. I was making the grades I was supposed to make. But, you know, I was not a reliable employee. I was not a reliable friend. I was not a good girlfriend or a good daughter. You know, I ultimately robbed my family of a daughter. Every time I was around them, I was drunk. You know, I had bottles hiding away in my closet, drinking every chance I got, you know, between classes. It became the joke on campus that there was wasted, white girl wasted, and Nora Allen wasted. Because, again, I had to take things to an excess. And when I'm actively drinking, I really am convinced in my mind that everyone else drinks the way that I do. And it's simply not true. You know, I take it to an extreme because I have this disease and this physical craving, this mental obsession that I can't relieve. After that first drink, I'm gone. And that's what continued to happen for me. Throughout my best efforts to stop, I could not stop. I was a college athlete, and the only time I could even briefly be sober, have periods of sobriety in college, was when I was in season. And the second the season ended, I was gone. Gone beyond recognition, drinking. I continued to surround myself with people who partied the way I did. A lot of good friends, people who cared about me, people who really had my best interests at heart, stopped talking to me and didn't want anything to do with me. And I don't blame them. I don't blame them because I was a train wreck, because I would say hurtful things. I would do hurtful things. I couldn't be counted on. I remember even telling my professors at one point in college that I had narcolepsy. That's why I was falling asleep in their class. Not that I was hungover. Not that I was still intoxicated. I had narcolepsy. And it was scary, too, because I work in a healthcare profession. I was in the process of earning a healthcare degree. And I would be taking care of people who had alcoholic liver disease, who had brain injuries, who had lifelong medical conditions and bodily damage from their drinking, from substances. And yet I would go home and do the same exact thing, thinking I was different, because that's what I always did. I couldn't compare in. I was always comparing out. You know, they say there's something, too, for coming to this room in the right timing and in a higher power's timing. When I was initially in that psychiatric facility, they didn't have any AA in the facility. They didn't have any kind of 12-step program that they brought to my attention. And initially, when I did come to AA, I was pretty angry about that. I was like, wow, somebody could have given me AA at that time, but the reality was I wasn't ready to hear it. You know, I was in such denial. And I had to drink a lot more before I was ready to have enough pain to admit that I had a problem. And I had the stories that were funny at the time, but looking back, were painful and shameful and embarrassing. You know, running around barefoot, half naked in the middle of Allentown at 3 a.m. because I didn't know where I was. I didn't know what I was doing. Fighting with cops, just all kinds of insanity, you know, trying to laugh it off the next day, saying, oh, if I didn't remember, it didn't happen. Hurting other people, and it was never a good enough excuse. People distancing themselves further from me, you know, constantly calling my dad for money, calling my dad to bail me out of the hospital again because I was in all these situations. And again, I was maintaining on the surface, but dying inside. And it got really bad. I had a couple bouts with alcohol poisoning. I had many bouts, many hospitalizations, just hurting people, not being able to show up. And I slowly began isolating. I became a shell of the person that I once was. I finally ended up dating somebody else who partied like I partied, and it was a pretty dismal existence. Nobody wanted to be around us. Nobody could stand to be around us because if we were around, things went missing. If we were around, your money went missing. If we were around, your house was a mess, and we didn't care. At that time, I kept focused on this person because I could not focus on myself. I could not look at what was going on with me and my own pain. So I said, oh, this person's an active addiction. They're the problem. They're the one we need to fix. And I was rallying around this person, trying to get them into rehab. Meanwhile, they were cleaning up after me. Meanwhile, they were trying to take care of me when I had alcohol poisoning because I was just as sick, but I couldn't see it. I didn't want to see it. And at that time, the person did enter treatment, and somebody had suggested to me another 12-step fellowship for the loved ones of addicts. I said, this is great. This is where I belong. If this person would just get well, all my problems would be solved. So I went to that fellowship for a little while, and it helped me to a degree. But it quickly became apparent to me that I had a little bit of a problem, and I wasn't ready to look at that. So I went back out. And during this time, I had many suicide attempts, multiple, some more successful than others. You know, I've been told it's kind of a miracle that I'm still alive today. I know it's a miracle I'm still alive today. I did a lot of damage to my body and to my organs, but everything since then has regenerated and healed. I made multiple attempts on my life. Every single morning I would wake up and I would be upset that I was still alive. You know, I couldn't look in the mirror anymore because I didn't recognize the person looking back at me. You know, I was an empty shell of a human being, and I was full of regret. You know, I couldn't talk to people because I didn't want them to really see what was going on with me. I couldn't be counted on. Literally all I did was wake up in the morning, get loaded, go to work, go to my internship, come home, get loaded, pass out. And it was a miserable existence. I remember being in the thick of things, being drunk, being out of my mind, and just praying to what I knew of a God, please, please, just let me get through this, and I'll never do this again. I'll never do this again. You know, begging God, you know, the prayers to the porcelain God on my knees, hugging the toilet, just begging God, please take this away from me, and I'll never drink again. And those are promises I couldn't keep. You know, I had a pretty religious upbringing. My family's very religious. I went to religious affiliated schools my entire life. So I had knowledge of this God thing. I had knowledge of, you know, the Bible and the scriptures and all these things. It went as far as my head. You know, I can recite things. I can tell you all kinds of things. But it never got to my heart. You know, it never really penetrated through that because there was such a thick wall around it. I was so surrounded by fear. I could never penetrate into my heart and have a meaningful experience with it. It was just this idea of this thing you called upon when you needed it, like Santa Claus, like the Easter Bunny, some fantasy thing that people made up that they had for their own use and their own purposes. And it didn't apply to me. Even more so, as I caused more harm and I caused more shame to myself and to other people, I didn't think that God wanted anything to do with me. I didn't think that God or a higher power would listen to somebody like me. But something happened, you know. What really began the end of my drinking was my grandmother's wake in 2013, in October. I had gone to a family party beforehand with some of my extended family who do drink the way I used to drink, but I swore that night I was going to take one shot. And to me, that's the perfect example of this disease, of the mental obsession, the physical craving, and how you get drunk on that first drink. Because I swore with all my being I was going to take a shot and that would be it. I took a shot and I was blackout drunk because once I start, I do not stop. I was on a run. I was drinking obsessively. So I get to the wake somehow. And in my drunken blackout, I start crying. I start making a scene. I start telling my father about all the things that had happened to me while I was drinking. All the things that happen to us ladies while we're drinking are things that we don't really want to tell everybody. There are things that, you know, maybe you talk about in the confidence of a sponsor, but it's certainly things you wouldn't make public knowledge. It's certainly things that are private, that are personal, that are painful, and that need a lot of healing. But I was so full of this emotion, full of this pain, it just spilled out of me. My mother, who should have been mourning her mother, was busy consoling her drunk 24-year-old daughter. Because I get consumed by this drink, I get consumed by this obsession, I can't think about anybody but myself. And the next morning, I came to my apartment. I don't know how I got there, but I did hear the events. And for a long time, I would always try and block my mind out. I would delete text messages. I wouldn't talk to people, you know, go back, try and erase all the things of the night before. But this was something I couldn't erase. You know, my family saw this. I ruined what should have been a really private, personal moment because of my drinking. And I'll never forget the next day, my father pulling me aside. And he's a big guy. He's 6'1", big Irish-American, hearty man. And him looking me in the eyes with tears in his eyes, and I think I've only ever seen him cry once, but with tears in his eyes, he said, "Nora, you can never drink again." And he was scared. He's a man I've never seen scared, but he was terrified because he knew he was losing me. And I couldn't even realize at the time I was losing myself. My mother does have a cousin in this program who recently celebrated 30-some-odd years, 33 years. She's an amazing woman, and I truly believe she was one of the people who really blazed the path for me to get to these rooms. She pulled my mom aside the next day and said, "You know, Nora drinks a lot like the way I used to drink. I'm going to pray for her to find these rooms." You know, we talk about praying for the newcomer. We talk about praying for the person who's still out there, the person who's still sick and suffering. And that was what she did for me. And it worked. Somehow it worked. You know, I continued to drink. Despite my best attempts of controlling my drinking, I continued to drink. For a while, I had tried to stop. I tried to switch to wine because gin and vodka, my drinks of choice, always put me over the edge. Well, I went from drinking a glass to an entire box because once I start, I cannot stop. You know, I get that phenomenon of craving, and one is not enough, and I don't know how to function without it. And December 26, 2013 was the day of my reckoning when it came to AA. But that night before my last drunk, and I will never forget my last drunk, God willing, I tried within all my power to get drunk and I could not get drunk. I was at a party, there was a lot of wine, and I kept drinking and drinking and drinking, and no matter what I did, I could not get drunk. It's terrifying. It was Christmas. I remember begging someone to stop at a liquor store so I could just get enough to feel comfortable. And that person refused and they were angry at me, so I went to bed angry that night. But something happened that next morning, and I can only describe it as the beginning of an experience with a higher power. Something happened, something came to me that made me Google, "Am I an alcoholic?" Which is a strange thing to do, but I did it. I Googled, "Am I an alcoholic?" And I took this little quiz that they had online, and it said to me, "You may have a serious problem with alcohol." And I really didn't like that answer. None of us would. So I took another one. And it still said, "You may have a serious problem with alcohol. You should talk to a healthcare professional about your problem with alcohol." So I walked up the stairs and I went to my boyfriend at the time and I said, "I'm an alcoholic." And he just looked in the eyes and he said, "I know." You know, the reality is as much as I or any of us thought that we were hiding this, as much as any of us thought we had this under control, we didn't. You know, people around us knew. People around us knew we were hurting. People around us knew we were in pain. We were just the last ones to see it sometimes. We have to come to that place of readiness and reckoning, the honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness that this program asks of us. When we get that gift of desperation, it's really that. It's really a gift because there are so many people who will never come to these rooms. There's so many people that get in these rooms, and they forget that. They forget that desperation. They forget that openness and that willingness. Even at 1 year, 2 years, 20 years, 30 years, I have to still have that. So I came into these rooms. I went to my first meeting, and no one was there, so I thought that was a sign that I wasn't an alcoholic, but someone kindly redirected me to another meeting. And I went there, and I sat down, and I was pretty proud of myself because they started talking about the young person who's scarcely more than a potential alcoholic. I said, "Great, I'm 25, I'm a potential alcoholic," and I was feeling pretty good about that. You know, I hadn't been to jail, I hadn't been to rehab, I hadn't crashed a car, I had all these hads. And then somebody introduced to me the lovely phrase, yet, you are eligible too. And I still am. I am still eligible for any of those consequences to happen to me if I pick up another drink. to do that further research. You know, they say, perhaps you're not a real alcoholic. Why don't you try some more controlled drinking? You know? And I was just ready. I was just ready to hear those words, but no one said them to me. A woman who was sitting next to me gave me a little bit of her experience, Strength and Hope. She gave me a little bit of her own story, her own experience, and it sounded far too familiar. So I kept coming back. And they talked about the whole sponsorship thing, and somebody put some literature in my hands, and I was scared. I was scared. There was this big book they called it. It didn't even have a real name. It was just the big book. But they gave me these colorful little magazines, these grapevines, and slowly but surely I got my way into it, and I finally asked a woman to sponsor me. And to this day, that's been one of the most beautiful experiences and greatest gifts of my life, that I got a sponsor. You know, she sat me down with the literature. She sat me down with the book, and we got into that book, and we did the work that this program asks of us, these 12 simple steps, this design for living that gave me a better life than anything I ever could have imagined for myself. You know, if I had known what was in store for me, you know, I wouldn't have believed it. I wouldn't have believed it. So we sat down, we talked about step one, the admitting I was powerless and my life had become unmanageable. And I was asked to make a list of all the ways I was powerless over alcohol and all the ways my life had become unmanageable. And things are very powerful when you put them down on paper. That's why they talk about doing an inventory in black and white. Because when you put it down on paper, you can no longer deny it. You're taking another sense to process it. All the things that I'd said I wouldn't do, I had done. You know, all the things that people I said I wouldn't hurt, I had hurt. And I was broken. I was broken enough to let some of that light get in. And that was exactly what started to happen. And I was told that the first step was the only one I had to do perfectly. And God willing, I will continue to do it. But every day, you know, when I begin my day, you know, I thank God for waking me up sober. And I ask God to help me stay sober another day, because I don't do this myself. But I have to remember on a daily basis that I am still an alcoholic and I'm still powerless. And if I take that other drink, my life can be unmanageable right again in a heartbeat. You know, step two, you know, becoming willing to believe in a power greater than myself. You know, I was trying to ride the coattails of the God of my childhood, the God of my childhood who I was terrified of, because I had been told from an early age, God is angry at you, God's punishing you, God's after your evilness. It was like this untouchable thing I could not touch. Again, in my head, but not in my heart. And it was introduced to me, the concept of having a higher power of your own understanding. And I said, well, maybe I can work with that. So my higher power at first was these rooms, the people in the rooms, because somehow, some way, when I was on edge, and I was early on in sobriety, when I came into these rooms, people would say things I needed to hear. People would say things that resonated in my heart, that started to penetrate through that barrier, and they got to me. So I said, you know what? I guess I can make these rooms my higher power. I guess I can go with that. And then having, you know, being willing to believe that this could restore me to sanity, you know, I showed up into these rooms believing that, hey, if I do this work, if I listen to these people, if I want what they have and I do what they did, maybe, just maybe, I can start to feel okay again. That was the beginning of step three for me. Today, with step three, with the way I live it, I am a case study in step three. I am a case study in taking back my will, getting my results, and realizing if I just turn it over to God, it's going to be okay. And it is amazing. It is unfailing. It is unfailing. The experiences I have had prior to getting sober, and even getting sober, I think I've had a lot more pain in sobriety than I ever did in my drinking days. A lot more difficult experiences coming my way. But by believing in a power greater than myself, believing that that power can do for me what I can't do for myself, I can walk through those situations without a drink. And that's the power of AA. That's the power of the 12 steps. I have to continue to practice step three on a daily basis. And sometimes it's a matter of stopping and pausing and just letting my higher power do what I can't do. It's not easy. My ego will fight it every single time. My ego will try and tell me, you can do this. You can do this. Don't worry about it. But the easiest solution is there. I just have to turn it over to God as I understand him. I looked at step four and I said, okay, this is just like confession. But it's not. It's so much more. There's a speaker who said that it's kind of like when you're a little kid and your parents tell you, okay, go clean your room. You're going to get rid of your old toys, the broken stuff, the things you don't play with anymore, and you're going to get brand new things. That's what a fourth step is. A nice, thorough fourth step, that thorough house cleaning. There's nothing like it. And so many people get terrified of it, but it's, you know, the reality is the core of the fourth step is it comes down to fear versus love. All of my character defects, when I look at the exact nature of my wrongs, they come down to fear. Sure, it harmed my pocketbook. Sure, it harmed my relations. But at the bottom of the core of it was fear. I'm fearful that you're better than me. I'm fearful that I'm not enough. I'm fearful that, you know, my pocketbook is harmed. I'm fearful of this. I'm fearful of that. And the only thing that is powerful enough to overcome fear is love. And my higher power, a pure higher power, is love. So that's what happens when I sit down and I put the nature of these things that I've been holding on to, these things, these people that I think wronged me and harmed me, and, you know, they deserve the worst. But when I actually look at those things and I actually see those things, there are people doing the best they can. And a lot of times it was me doing the best I can. And if I want to be forgiven, if I want to be loved, if I want to be appreciated and respected, I have to be able to extend those things to another human being. The only person who can give me the willingness to do that is a higher power. The other parts of a fourth step as well is a sex inventory. It's paramount. You know, until I could repair the damage and the wreckage of my past, I could not have a healthy relationship with another human being. I could not show up to be a healthy partner. You know, for me, that was like clearing a major boulder in my path. I had to actually admit powerless and unmanageability in my personal relationships, and turn it over to a higher power of my own understanding so that my higher power could provide me with a relationship greater than anything I ever could have imagined for myself. You know, the program and the principles that we have outlined in the steps, it's a design for living, and it's a design for living that applies in every single area of our life. Looking at my fears, the reality was is I was afraid of everything. And I still can be afraid of everything. I mean, that's where step three comes in. But when I look at step four and I look at those activators, you know, those things that really set me off, you know, and I actually put them on paper. They didn't look so big. They didn't look so bad. They didn't look so scary. You know, it's my own mind. I have a disease of perception. I have a disease of thinking. And it's a matter of putting it in the hands of something greater than me to get relief. The other reality, too, is looking at character defects. You know, it's like, oh, I have to make a list of everything that's wrong with me. But it's not. That's my spiritual barometer, ultimately. That's my spiritual barometer. It's when I take a look at that list and I see where I fall short. I see where I struggle. Those are the things that when they start to pop up, oh, gosh, I got to call my sponsor about that one. Yeah, maybe I should get to a meeting and talk to somebody about that, because those are the things that will lead me to a drink. If it's a resentment, if it's anger, if it's being short-tempered, if it's being self-righteous, if it's being full of ego, those are things I need to look at before I take the drink. You know, they're a gift today. They're an asset today. And the reason why I need step five is to share all that with another human being, with another woman who has walked this path, who can give me the insight and the perspective. You know, every time I've ever done a fourth and a fifth step with a woman, there's a little bit of resentment because ultimately she told me something I didn't want to hear about myself. But those have been some of the most valuable things I have ever heard. You know, I've been blessed to work with some amazing woman, both as a sponsor and as a sponsee. And I always get something out of that process. You know, whether I'm listening, whether I'm talking, you know, it's an exchange and it's a flow of experience, because our experience is our greatest gift today. Step six and seven, it's pretty comical. When I first got to step six and seven, I was like, great, I'm going to pray and all my character defects are going to be gone. But, you know, just as when I was drinking, God is not a magic fairy. God is not the Easter Bunny. God is not Santa Claus. There is action and more action, they tell us. And the action for me is to take notice. The action for me is to look at where I'm not balanced, to look at where I need to make a change, to look at, you know, sometimes one thing at a time. You know, they tell us to keep things simple in this program, and that's what I do. You know, on a daily basis, when I have my conversation with my higher power, I'm looking at what character defects have been popping up in a 10th step, and I'm making it a point to bring those things up, to ask how I might act, that I might be a better conduit of God's message, of God's purpose for me, of service, of how to be relieved of those things if it's God's purpose for me, you know. The reality is if I was relieved of all my character defects right away, I would not need the rest of the 12 steps. I would not need a higher power. I would not need to come to these meetings, and I would not need to help anybody else. But for me, that's not how these things work, and for that I'm grateful, because when I keep coming, when I got to do the rest of the steps, when I live the rest of these steps, I'm continuing to grow, and I'm getting that life beyond my wildest dreams. I'm getting a life beyond my imagination. Steps eight and nine, I had a lot of fear there, and a lot of us do. How on earth am I going to talk to some of these people? You know, and I was very eager to make amends to certain people, but fortunately, I had a sponsor who pointed out in a loving way to me, what are your intentions? What is your purpose there? You know, I have to look at my intentions on making my amends, because if my intent and my purpose is selfish, it's not an amends I have any business of making. You know, I have to be mindful that I'm not causing anyone else any harm today, because I can still do that. I'm still a human being, and I'm still an alcoholic, and I'm still self-centered and selfish to the extreme, left untreated. So it was a great learning process to actually get honest and to actually look at my role in things, because I came into these rooms with a lot of resentments. There are people I wish death on, and I'm not proud to say that today, but those are the people I learned the most by making amends to, by not expecting anything in return, but being able to say, I had a part in this. I caused you harm, and for that, I'm sorry. How can I make it up to you? Because it is not about me in that moment. It's about that person. It's about me making things right where I did them wrong. Step 10 is an amazing gift that I will admit that early on in sobriety, I didn't appreciate. I didn't take it on as much as I should have today, and today I love it because it's my spiritual barometer. It is that tool that I use on a nightly basis. You know, my first sponsor told me it's a system of credits and debits. I get to look at what I did well, and I get to look at where I still need to do some work. And for me, if something pops up more than one day, it's something I have to take to my sponsor. I have to have a conversation about, because that stuff is too heavy for me to carry. And if I'm carrying way too heavy of a load, a drink is going to sound like a really good idea. So I practice the 10th step. And sometimes I have to stop and I have to take that inventory in the middle of the day. If I'm that clogged up and I'm that stopped up, it's too heavy to carry. You know, I have a solution. I have a place where I can take it and I can get rid of it. Step 11, was a beautiful experience for me. They talk about having a spiritual experience as a result of these steps, but I had an experience within the 11th step. I was trying a lot of different things, going to different houses of worship, going to different kinds of meeting, practicing meditation. Meditation is huge for me today. That's where I get grounded. That's where I get centered. That's where I hear and I listen, because I will talk every day of the week. I will talk until I lose my voice. But when I get silent and I really listen, that's when, you know, the intuitive thought or action comes to me. And sometimes the intuitive thought or action is to not say or do anything. But if I don't get silent to allow that to happen, you know, God doesn't get to work into me and through me. You know, I talked about how the rooms were my higher power, but I came to believe in a God of my understanding. I call it God, but I really can't put a finger on it. And the cool thing is that you get to have your own power. Some people don't call it God, and that's okay too. Mine is a loving, all-knowing, all-being presence. And the way a spiritual experience happened for me was a situation I was trying to control, which is what my natural way of being is. It's what I default to, is trying to control and trying to put my hands in it. I was crying and I was all choked up on this experience, but I remember stopping and pausing and all of a sudden feeling a rush of calm come over me as I prayed. A rush of calm like I've never felt before, that things would actually be okay. And in the end, they were. They definitely didn't work out any way that I had planned that they would, and today I'm grateful for that. But that's what I continue to have. I continue to have that experience when I bring my problems to a higher power, when I get silent in meditation, when I talk in prayer. You know, for me, I love the 3rd step prayer, the 7th step prayer, the 11th step prayer, and the set aside prayer. It was so great to hear that, because that was really big to me in early sobriety. I said that every single morning, just wanting to have a new experience because I was so full of fear. But today, I like to have a lot of conversations with my higher power. Just talking about what's on my heart, talking about the people in my life, talking about where I'm at, and then listening for that response in meditation, and just getting quiet, and just letting those things come to me. The 12th step is probably one of the most greatest gifts that we have in this program, to get to work with another alcoholic. There's nothing more short of amazing when God puts my hand in the hand of another alcoholic, and I can try and bring them to their higher power of their own understanding. You know, things come alive in this book. You know, words, they just seem to fly off the page, and it's just, I leave and it's like, it renders me speechless what happens. But that's the stuff that I need to do to stay sober. You know, they tell us that practical insurance against the first drink, you know, is working with another alcoholic. And I still need to do that today. You know, I love to do that today. You know, I was scared at first. I was like, how on earth can I possibly communicate anything? I'm too new. I'm too young. I'm too this. And it's like God will bring the right people into my life at the right time. And God has never failed to do that between sponsees, between service commitments, between sponsors. You know, I've worked with a couple different women who've all imparted very beautiful things to me into my life. You know, they talk about the triangle in this program. The service element is huge. You know, whether I'm putting my hand out to the next alcoholic, if I'm, you know, right now I'm serving District 47, which is amazing. You know, it's a lot to learn about humility. It's a lot to learn about ego leveling. But it's a gift to serve this program and to see what happens on a greater level. Like when they're translating the big book into another language in a part of the world where they don't have Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when they're putting out a new PSA to reach the person who is maybe riding on the subway in New York City, their head is still in the bottle and they're looking for a way out. You know, in a small way, every single one of us gets to be part of that greater solution, you know, because that was there, you know. And I think back to that institution that I was at and how Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't there. And, you know, I hope today, I haven't been back there, it's in Connecticut, but I really hope today that somebody is bringing that message in. One of the things I really love today is bringing the meetings into the prisons. I've never been to prison. I was terrified. I was like, how are you going to expect me to talk to a woman in prison and have anything to give to this person? But we have this common experience. They talk about us being like the you know, the fellow travelers on the shipwrecked ship. And we have that bond that the dying can only share. And that's exactly it. We feel the same. We feel the same. If I fail to do this work, I will perish. I cannot do it on my own. You know, and I've had some amazing experiences beyond this. You know, you talk about sobriety. I was actually at my cousin's wedding this past weekend in Virginia, and out of state, you know, it's always interesting when you travel out of state and there's alcohol everywhere. You walk into Target, there's boxes of wine. You walk into Chipotle, there's Coronas. So it was pretty amazing when I went to the ceremony and I stopped my parents after and I said, hey, we're going to a meeting. I went to a meeting, and, you know, for as uncomfortable as I had been in the moment, you know, with family and people I hadn't seen in a long time, I walked into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous and I felt at home. I was among my people. I was among people who understood who I was, where I was, without even saying a word. And that's the power of this fellowship. That's the, you know, the camaraderie and the love and the bond that we share. So I went to an amazing meeting and I was able to show up for my family sober today. And that's the greatest gift I can give. That's the greatest amends I can make to anybody. I'll never forget the time I was on the phone with my father. I was getting ready for State Convention of Young People, which is also a huge part of my sobriety, getting involved with my fellow young people, you know, because we get this new way of life. And we don't cease to live and cease to grow and cease to have fun because we get sober. We get that much more opportunity because we're sober. But I remember talking to my father, calling him to just see how he was doing, because that's the nature of our relationship today. I can call my father and say, hey, how are you doing? What's going on? What can I do for you today? And as soon as I was going to start talking, he said to me, you don't need to tell me how well you're doing. I can hear it in your voice. You know, and this is a man who was terrified. Who was terrified. He really didn't think I was necessarily going to live to see another day, week, month, or year. You know, being able to check in with him. My father had gotten diagnosed with cancer when I was in the thick of my addiction. And I couldn't show up for him. You know, I was there, but I wasn't there. I was hungover. I was drunk. And I used his disease as fuel to fuel my drinking, because I didn't need an excuse, but if I had an excuse, I would ride it to the extreme. But in sobriety, I get to show up. In sobriety, I get to be there for people. You know, not because I want to see what I can get out of it, but because it's the right thing to do today. The relationships I have with other people, you know, they're based on love. You know, when I'm calling people up, it's not about unloading all my problems, but rather listening to what they have to say. You know, in a relationship with a higher power is probably the most amazing thing I never wanted, but I could always have hoped for. It's that sense of peace that I have on a daily basis. When I do, you know, when I'm in prayer, when I'm in meditation, when I'm going to meetings, I reach out about that stuff. You know, this is the greatest gift that any of us can ever hope to receive. You know, we just have to be willing to receive it. The fellowship is powerful. You know, your life doesn't end where this program begins. As I've shared, I had a lot of painful experiences happen to me in sobriety. I had one particular instance. It was something that I never dreamed about facing drinking, and I certainly didn't hope to experience sober. But I have a sponsor. I have a program. I have sponsees. I have service commitments. And I have a higher power. All those things kept me accountable. All those things kept me sober through my experience. And one of the things that I had heard very early on is that all your pain and all your experience is going to be your greatest asset. You're going to take it, you're going to carry it, and you're going to help another person with it. And that's exactly what I've been able to do since. You know, I've walked other women through those experiences. We've had those late night tearful phone calls, and we've had the right words to say. And that's also the intuitive thought or action that comes to me when I'm connected to a higher power. That's the awareness that comes to know what to say. Because on my own, I don't know what to say. On my own, I'm going to be fumbling for words. I'm going to be tripping and stumbling and just grasping at straws, trying to show up and trying to understand. But you guys in these rooms, you taught me how to show up. You know, you taught me how to live life and how to face things sober. And it's been an experience beyond my wildest dreams. It's not about the material things. It's not about the job. It's not about the relationship. It's about showing up today. It's about liking myself. You know, I talked about wanting to kill myself, waking up every single morning and being upset that I was still alive. But now I wake up with sincere and profound gratitude that I'm still here, that there's a purpose for me, that there's a reason I'm still going, that there's a reason that I get to be here, that I get to show up today. And that's not me. That's God. And that's this program, and that's all of you. So thank you for this experience. Thank you for being part of my journey and allowing me to have a life beyond my wildest dreams. Thank you.